Hello and welcome to the FV English podcast, your one-stop shop for Venezuelan football in English, bringing you fortnightly episodes dedicated to the Venezuelan league, the national teams and the myriad of Venezuelan players around the world.
Tonight we will be looking towards the upcoming World Cup qualifiers for Venezuela, at home to Brazil and Ecuador before an away trip to Chile. Chile being the only opponents that Venezuela have beaten so far in qualification campaign. The last time Dominic and I were speaking about the World Cup qualifiers, there was a difference of opinion as to whether the campaign for Venezuela was over. I consider it is, and Dominic thinks there's still an outside chance, or did when we were last recording on the topic. Dominic, with what's happened since, and to summarise for listeners, that's no permanent coach appointed as of yet, so Leo Gonzalez continues as interim. A number of notable absences for this call as well. Do you still hold the same opinion that there's an outside chance?
I think I will enter this break feeling that there's the ability to keep the hope alive. Not necessarily that there's a real chance of us qualifying, but that we can do there. It's possible for us to do enough in the window to keep it mathematically possible. I admit with the absences we'll talk about later that I am far less optimistic than I probably could be, but I'm not hopeless about there at least being good results this window.
And that in itself is a pretty ballsy thing to say, given in September's triple date it was 3 games and 3 defeats. And I guess there's probably a fair amount of people that will argue that the Venezuela squad, which I'll run down through in a minute, is perhaps weaker than it was for September's dates. Where do you see the points coming? To reiterate, Brazil and Ecuador at home and then away against Chile.
I don't think that there'll be any points picked up against Brazil. Even if we had a full strength squad, that would be quite unlikely considering that no one else has been able to get points off them. So no matter what we looked like, I would expect not to get points there. Ecuador, they've had a relatively good start, so I don't necessarily see a win there. I do see it possible for us to match up against them. Obviously, an extremely reserved side of ours managed to be competitive against them in the Copa America this summer. That gives me some loose source of hope. And then Chile, I mean, like you said, it's a team that we did manage to beat, albeit with a very different roster available, but they have plenty of issues on their end. They have one win more than us, otherwise they've had a pretty poor campaign themselves. And I'll have some hope that maybe we can recreate a similar result against them.
And it was the high point of Venezuela's World Cup qualifying campaign so far, with the Salomon Rondon getting a winning goal 10 minutes from time at El Olimpico in Caracas. Obviously, an away game will pose something very different. But like you said, they're barely faring much better. And a good set of results for Venezuela could actually see them rise above Chile. To summarise for listeners, Colombia are in fifth. And I highlight fifth because that is where you need to be in with a shot of World Cup qualifying. Top four, automatically fifth, enter a playoff. So Colombia are fifth on 13 points and Venezuela are bottom 10th on 4 points. So a 9-point swing is needed, which is exactly what's up for grabs in this window. And to clarify, 9 games in to an 18-game qualifying campaign. So exactly at the halfway mark. To run down the team, 28-man squad, coming down from a 50-man shortlist. And very quickly, goalkeepers are Wilker Fariñez, Joel Graterol, and Luis Romero. Romero plays his football in Venezuela for Portuguesa FC and is probably one of, if not the most impressive goalkeeper in the league this season. Defenders, Roberto Rosales, Ronald Hernandez, Pablo Bonilla, returning for the first time in a while. John Chancellor, Adrian Martinez, who plays his football in Venezuela, Nahuel Ferraresi, Josio Mejias, again, a returnee after quite a while absent from the national team. Christian McCune, Oscar Gonzalez, another player playing in Venezuela, Daniel Carrillo, Thomas Rincon, the captain, Junior Moreno, Bernardo Manzano of Deportivo Lara in Venezuela, Edson Castillo of Caracas Football Club, Christian Castro's Junior, Jose Martinez, Edward Bello, Jefferson Soteldo, and Adalberto Peñaranda, again returning for the first time in quite a while. And then the forwards are Darwin Machis, Giancarlo Sotaro, Sergio Cordova, Brian Hurtado, a call-up from Cobresal in Chile on loan from Mineros de Guiana, Eric Ramirez, and Fernando Aristegueta. That is the selection, and we will talk about the absentees afterwards, but surely the best place to start is with the 28-man team itself. Where do you see the strengths in this call-up that Leo Gonzalez has? His second call-up since becoming manager, but probably the first one, it's fair to say, where he's been able to give full thought and attention, because obviously the first call-up was very, very short notice.
Yeah, I think that's probably even just worth pointing out first as the strength of the roster as a whole is just the fact that the folks that will be in charge will have had any real thought about the people on the list. As far as strengths and the players there, you know, there's the plus side of the midfield options are more or less what would have been there regardless of absences other than Herrera. So, you know, the guys that have been starting games basically for the last year are all there, given how many key absences there are in other parts of the pitch. That's, you know, seems like a good source of stability for me. Otherwise, you know, obviously it's interesting to see a lot of young guys and the defensive and attacking options, the Macoons, the Peñarandas, that, you know, while those options probably will leave some less hopeful about results, it is interesting to see those options there. Obviously, a lot of the usual starters that have been featuring haven't necessarily been performing. So there's always a good question mark around some new blood or returning blood to the roster. So I'm optimistic about perhaps how some of those guys that haven't been around for a bit, even Machis, who just has been injured for some breaks, how some of those returning or new faces will interact with the team.
Yeah, and I think one thing that stands out to me more and more as this World Cup qualifying campaign comes on is not just the number of MLS players in the Venezuela team, but also their increasing prominence in terms of responsibility and performance. In particular, Brujo Martinez from Philadelphia Union and Christian Castro's Jr. from New York Red Bulls, who obviously missed September's triple date as he was still returning from injury. For those who aren't familiar with MLS or perhaps aren't even that familiar with the Venezuelan national team, what can you tell us about Pablo Bonilla? Because he's one who hasn't been in the national team for quite some time, did play for the youth ranks, but potentially there's a possibility that he'll see minutes in this triple date, given it is probably one of the weakest areas of the field for the senior team at the moment.
Yeah, I was very interested to see him get the call because obviously even, I mean, really for the last 3-4 years, there's been a lot of conversations about fullbacks. So, you know, he plays for the Portland Timbers, for those that don't know, under the guidance of Savarese. He is not a guaranteed starter with that team, but he does get a good amount of minutes. Not so much because of his having or lacking of quality, but just because they have several options for that, for his position. And the competitor is a more experienced player, so he's, you know, a little bit of an uphill battle there. But Bonilla performs well when he plays. Certainly has done a share of experience last year, meaning 2020. He played a relatively big role in Portland winning the MLS's back tournament, which was sort of a mini cup tournament that they had in a bubble when they returned to play during the pandemic. Since then, you know, he's continued to fight for minutes, start some games, subs in some games, on the bench for some games. You know, I think there's been encouraging signs of development for him over the last couple of years. He's gotten better results this last year and a half than when he first joined to Portland. And, you know, he's under the guidance of a very talented manager and a Venezuelan manager, which I suppose is a good thing. And he's also playing with Renzo Zambrano. So there's another Venezuelan connection there. Yeah, you know, I'll say he's not necessarily the most exciting name on the list, but I am encouraged to see him continue to develop as a player and get these opportunities, because he's still quite young and he does come off as the guy that has the potential to grow into something more than where he's at right now.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing him. His one previous national team call-up resulted in a debut not happening. So, of course, he has the possibility of making his senior team debut, like I said, after representing Venezuela at youth level. But another MLS player in the defence, and one that I think probably has been one of those players that people have spoken about for the national team for 2 or 3 years now, but very much feels like this call coincides with him earning his place in the team. I don't watch too much MLS, but from what I follow on Twitter and, of course, your dedication to MLS on Football English, Christian McCune has grown in prominence for Inter Miami this season, playing a more important role, and subsequently has the call up to the national team.
Yeah, he, you know, his first year there was very rocky. He spent a chunk of the year on loan to their USL League One or third division team, Fort Lauderdale. This season has been far better. He's started a significant portion of their games and made substitute appearances in others. He's had runs of good results. Off the top of my head, I don't have it written down, but I'll say there was a 6-8 game streak where he didn't lose, a combination of wins and draws. And there have been some losses for him, but he's been a more constant presence for Inter Miami this year, playing with some really talented players across the field. Obviously, they have the Higuain brothers and Matuidi and those sorts of guys, Shawcross. So, you know, I think it's been a big year for him. Certainly an important one, given that it seemed like his career was a little stuttering a little bit, maybe. You know, his initial time at Inter Miami was not as explosive as I think a lot of people were hoping. So, yeah, it's been a big year for him. And I think, you know, whether or not he gets a lot of minutes this break, I think it's another, like Bonilla, it's a good show of progression for him that he's getting this acknowledgement. And hopefully it helps continue to grow his confidence and maybe helps him develop as a player.
And what I saw of him at Inter Miami is that he seems to have got game time at left back and centre back. It surprised me to see him at left back, just from obviously his time in Liga Football was centre back or even holding midfield, and same for the Venezuela youth ranks. Do you see him being an option at both for the national team? Because the obviously left back has been a discussion point in the Venezuela national team for a couple of years now, probably the discussion point. But with this particular triple date, centre back is weaker than usual. There's no Jordan Osorio again, but there's also, as we're going to talk about in more depth in a minute when we talk about the absentees, no Mikel Villanueva. So centre backs, we've got John Chancellor, Adrian Martinez, Nahuel Ferraresi, Josue Meas, and potentially McCune.
Yeah, I think my guess would be that their intention would be to play him as a center back. That's been this season particularly, that's, you know, been his main spot last season as well. Between Inter Miami and Fort Lauderdale, he played mostly as a center back or as a defensive midfielder. He certainly can play left back, and he has in recent times, but I would be surprised if that was a main plan of theirs to use him that way. I'd expect if that did happen, it would be as a contingency. I would expect them mostly to plan for him to be a center back.
And with McCune and Bonilla, a common factor in the two is their age. They're both very young players, and you picked up on it in one of your earlier answers, but also when we were talking about the absentees over the weekend, you made an interesting point about that you feel that perhaps some of the uproar over the absentees was sort of like a false outrage. And just to set the scene for listeners, four players were made... well, we're given news. The Football Federation chose to give reasons for four of the absentees. Of course, from a 50-man squad down to 28, that's 22 players that don't make it. But four in particular were given reasons to the public from the Federation as to why they were absent. Three players, Josef Martinez, Jefferson Savarino, and Mikel Villanueva were basically described as injured and therefore unavailable, still in recuperation, still in recovery. And the fourth player was Salomon Rondon. The reason given is that his club, Everton, had requested that he wouldn't be called and the Federation chose to oblige. What then happened from Friday onwards when this statement was made is that Mikel Villanueva started for Santa Clara in Portugal, as did Josef Martinez for Atlanta United in MLS, and Jefferson Savarino saw minutes from the bench in the second half. And over the course of the weekend, journalists and fans alike were very vociferous in highlighting the apparent contradiction. But as I said in my preamble to this, you saw a lot of it as false outrage. And instead of me telling the listeners the very succinct reasons you gave, run us through why you think that.
Yeah, I'll focus on the injuries. So it is not, this will be my main point, and then I'll try to break it down for the three different players. There is, I have seen people that I respect, journalists, argue that it is not common for players navigating on and off injuries to be requested by their clubs to not be involved with their national team for a break, and for the national teams to negotiate that out, and sometimes maybe have the player not come at all. I've seen people claim that is not a thing that happens. Those people are saying something that is not true. This happens. It's happened to Vino Tinto. It's happened to countless other national teams through history. This happens all the time. National team coaches are in constant communication with the coaches of their players, if they're doing their job right anyways. They're supposed to be. Gonzalez admittedly is like interim, so I don't know what his link is with those coaches, but I imagine it's at least partially what it's supposed
to
be.
At least somebody in the Federation should be playing.
Right, right. So just to lay that out, that is normal for that conversation to happen, and for sometimes the decision to be for the player not to leave. That happens. So people saying that it doesn't happen are lying to you, or they don't know what they're talking about. That's just a fact. It's just a fact, not an opinion. From there, so you know, the original release of those four players not being involved, one of the problems, that communication errors that seemed to happen, was that the release did not fully indicate why. And later there was a press release that kind of explained, well, we talked to the clubs and blah, blah, blah. But I understand that leaving that out means that some people did not know and maybe didn't want to assume that that was the case. But one of those players, Josef Martinez, before the outrage, had played and scored his 100th goal against Inter Miami, and there was a lot of press around that. And in the press, after that game, he told Felipe, oh my gosh.
Cardona?
I love this guy. I don't know how I'm forgetting his name. I just want to make sure I get it right. Yeah, Cardenas. He told him, and this was tweeted, he writes for The Athletic. He's a very official reporter. He's Atlanta United's main reporter for The Athletic, and a very reputable reporter. He tweeted about how Josef told the press that because his knee was still on and off, he would not be going to the national team. This was days before the outrage.
Okay.
And then when the press release came out days later explaining, well, we talked to the team and the coach, and and they told us not to. When that got said after the outrage, people said, well, why didn't you tell us that before? Well, Josef was telling you. Mm-hmm. But you weren't looking at all the sources, and then you decided to report claiming that you knew everything that was known. So, you know, in a lot of these cases, there is information being left out. There's information being left out that makes it easier to be upset. Uh-huh. With Mikel, yeah, he started that game, but he got subbed off at halftime. He only played 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it was 0-0 at halftime. It wasn't like he played badly. So clearly the coach wasn't even sure about that. Savarino was a sub. So, you know, if it feels like people are claiming that they're saying they're injured and then they went and scored a hat trick and played 90 minutes. That's not really what's happening. Josef, by the way, played Montreal after all this started to happen. Had to get subbed off at halftime because his knee wasn't feeling good. Mm-hmm. And now I just saw, I think from Felipe, I saw a report today saying he might be out for the next 2 games. So people are being selective. People are being selective with how they're taking in the information about these things. In the first place, they're pretending that this is an uncommon relationship between national team and club. And then they're ignoring very official information. I mean, Joseph literally said it.
Yeah.
Joseph literally said it on camera. And they're ignoring this public information days before the thing that gets them upset. And then making, so to me, that is, and look, maybe some of these people just aren't doing the right reporting. So maybe it's not on purpose, but either way, it's misleading. It's misleading people. I'll add on to that on a separate note in regard to Salomon Rondon and in connection to the youth on the roster.
Yeah.
For a year, we've been hearing how he's too old and he shouldn't even be there and how we need to be younger. And especially after the last break, I saw almost every major Venezuelan football reporter you can think of talking about, well, we need to be younger next break and use it as a development opportunity. I mean, even we kind of talked about that. And then he's off and there's some young guys. Well, why isn't he here? Why are we bringing in McCoon and Peñaranda? Why aren't we going for our veterans? Why aren't we forcing Everton to send him? That, again, and from some of the same people are saying this as the complaint before that I mentioned. So again, for me, I don't know if they even interpret it as being a bad thing, what they're doing, but to me, it's very misleading the way people are talking about these absences. They all make sense to me. They all seem deserved, and they all seem rational. It sucks. I wish they were all there. I wish they were there too, but people are, I see people almost building a, there's that, I don't know if everyone that listens to this, there's that famous meme people use from Always Sunny in Philadelphia of the character with the red yarn connecting the newspaper clippings, the conspiracy theory. And he has kind of a crazy face, you know, he's been awake too long. There are people creating webs of supposed corruption around these four absences and the miscommunication about them. And it, to me, that just, I mean, hey, maybe that's true, but we have no reason to believe it's true. We have no reason to believe it's true. It's all very explainable to me. So it's upsetting to see people report like this about what should be a very straightforward topic. That to me is dangerous. There's already enough negativity around this team. We don't need to be making more.
Yeah.
So I'll leave it at that.
No, I don't disagree with your final point, but two things off the back of that intrigue me is, do you feel, so you spoke a lot in your answer about like the journalistic response to the absentees, I guess. But what about from a fan perspective as well? Because obviously like you're a fan, I'm a fan. And there were a lot of fans feeling that this was perhaps just the latest in the line of incidents that feed into this bigger idea that there is a lack of commitment shown to the national team by players over the past 3 or 4 years. Is there, in your opinion, is there any credibility to be led to that theory, or is it just a tribalistic emotional response that fans are prone to have to particularly national teams, because national teams are so symbolic to a country?
Yeah, look, I'm as annoyed as everyone else that often when it matters most, a lot of the players you'd like to have aren't there. I'm as annoyed as anyone else. What I will say is there are times when I'll admit it feels odd the way some of that plays out. And there are times when it doesn't really. Joseph Martinez has been dealing with an injury for 2 years.
Yeah.
This issue is old. This has been happening forever now. He's posted the pictures of what his knee looked like with all the stitches and bolts in it. In that video where he does that speech after his 100th goal, he's got an ice pack the size of my head on his knee.
Yeah.
This is, so that to me, I don't feel suspicious about that. That's science. I don't see any strangeness behind that. I know less about Villanueva's injury. I know less about Savarino's injury, although it did seem to happen during a game, a Venezuela game. So in that sense, I saw something happen that would lead me to believe it was real and serious. It looked like it potentially was in the upper thigh or groin. That's a very difficult area to heal. So, you know, yeah, I'll admit I can't speak to detail about Villanueva's injury, but with the other two, I mean, I don't know. It seems like these are real injuries that often are very difficult to heal from and very on and off. We've seen, again, I mean, if Atlanta lost that game against Montreal that Joseph left at halftime, if he wanted, if he could play, I promise you he would. I promise you he would, because his entire legacy at that team is playing more than he really should and working a little too hard for Atlanta United. If he could have played an extra 15 minutes to help them get a goal, I'm sure he would have. It would be very out of character for him not to.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that sense, I, from what I have to work with, I understand that it falls into that narrative. I do. But I think sometimes that's coincidence. Sometimes people are really hurt and really can't play.
Yeah. And the second thing I wanted to pick up on is the fact that the Venezuelan Football Federation then released a communication, you know, a lot more detail given, a lengthier communication. I think yesterday, so Monday, after the weekend of speculation, after the weekend of anger, I guess, from fans, the Federation did actually feel the need to release a statement clarifying the issues. And you and I spoke about it Saturday on WhatsApp that whilst I wasn't sharing the same anger that many were on social media, what I did say to you and what I did tweet myself is that's why there's, to me, an importance to being transparent and consistent in communications. And I felt like there was just what they did say in their first announcement sort of fueled the fire. And I saw a few people say similar in different ways. Richard Mendes, for example, said that, you know, it would have been better had they just said nothing. All they've done is not his exact words, but all they've done is add fuel to the fire, like I said. So is that the Federation, do you think, owning up to the fact that they weren't clear enough, or is it quelling some of the conspiracy theories over the weekend, or is it just accountability?
Well, I think everyone can agree that, you know,
because amongst all this, we had Savarino saying that he wasn't even called.
Right. Yeah. I think what everyone can agree on is that the Federation did a poor job of communicating what they wanted to communicate, or what it seemed like they wanted to communicate. They clearly wanted to point out why players weren't available, but they also clearly did not do a great job of doing that. I think that's all true. And I think they could have done significantly better. And therefore, yes, did fuel the issue. I guess my issue that with everything I've said on this episode is I feel like journalists and reputable accounts that should know better and could have looked for the information did as much fueling and could have not. And so when you have the entire Venezuelan football internet blowing up, I just doubt that it would have been as bad if a couple of those journalists had pointed out a couple key facts and kept everything realistic. That's my concern with what I was saying earlier. But yeah, I mean, look, the way those things were communicated by the Federation was not great. Not that any football federation in the planet has a history of being great with communication, but certainly it could have been better. It could have been better. Or perhaps left alone in totality and then have, you know, in a press conference later, just have them mention if someone asks. But yeah, if this happens, if, you know, Nets break, there are players unavailable that would be expected to be there, they should certainly do a better job of deciding what they want to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a fair summary. And to move away from the absentees and focus on the 28 men that we do have and the hopes that we have for the next three games, Brazil, first and foremost, on Thursday, at home, Ecuador at home, Chile away. The new faces, surely given that, you know, many of the new faces are at critical points in their season with their clubs, you'd expect to perhaps see them play. I'm thinking Brian Hurtado, who's playing in Chile, 10 goals, 4 assists, got an assist today. And that's 14 goal involvements in 22 or 23 games, having a very good season. He plays predominantly left mid or left wing, depending on the formation, thinking hopefully he gets some game time. Fernando Aristegueta missed out in September, but through, you know, injury, not he wasn't called, and is now in this selection. And probably you'd say, because Zardo is not going to play up front as a centre forward, arguably probably the player with the most form going into this, because Eric Ramirez hasn't been called for the last couple of Dynamo Kiev games. Obviously, after September's World Cup qualifiers, he tested positive for COVID and had to stay away for a few days before returning to Ukraine. Jan Atardo did score at the weekend, but again, it was off the bench and also his first goal of the season. So the strike force isn't strong, but surely there's opportunity for the new faces like Adalberto Peñaranda, for example, to get more game time. Edward Bayo, who I think did all right in the game against Peru, likewise, not a striker, but, you know, an attacking midfielder.
Yeah, you know, I think we'll have to assume for the sake of the conversation that, you know, formation, all these kinds of things stay within relative what they've been, even though sometimes that does change the personnel, but we'll assume that that's going to be consistent. Yeah, I think Aristegueta is going to be an important element to have. Obviously, he was relied upon heavily this summer for the Copa America. Did not score, but was quite good for what it seemed like he was really supposed to do, which was kind of hold up the ball and kind of be a first defender and just kind of help the mentality of the team. It would be interesting to see if he ends up getting trusted with some serious playtime. Sergio Cordova has been getting like real minutes for Augsburg recently, which I was actually surprised at because it seemed like that wasn't going to happen, but he actually just started this week against Dortmund. I don't know if I would start him, but there's a chance that he'll be in that conversation as well because he's getting like real minutes in a top league. Attacking options is probably where I feel that we've been hit the most, more in the striker sense. But it'll be interesting to see what this sort of strange mix of intense experience or extreme youth gets translated into. And like you were kind of pointing out, there's a couple players that could potentially kind of be played a little more forward that typically are more on the wing. It'll kind of be interesting to see how, you know, Peñaranda has been kind of listed as sort of a semi-striker at Las Palmas. So it'll be interesting to see how some of that translates for Gonzalez.
Yeah, and I'm curious more to see how the Brazil game is approached, because,
yeah,
like you say, that they haven't dropped points against anyone. They've only conceded 2 goals as well in 8 games. Right. And, you know, if there is any mentality amongst the team, the federation, to hunt for that 5th and final qualification place, which seems, you know, so far away when we're bottom at the moment, perhaps considering 3 games in the space of 8 days, it wouldn't be the worst approach to save some players for Ecuador. Ecuador at home, perhaps out of the 3, is the game where you'd feel most able to get points.
Yeah, and I imagine the momentum that you would get from actually having like a win in front of fans would, of course, be incredibly encouraging. I think it would probably be smart to approach the Brazil game in a more defensive manner, almost akin to the Copa America mentality, and see what you can do. You know, maybe a draw out of that. Otherwise, you know, damage control. Simply because that team has just been so good. Ecuador at home, if you can save up the energy and whatever happens against Brazil happens, and then you get a good result against Ecuador, I don't think anybody's going to complain about whatever Brazil does to us. So if they do that, I would see the logic to it. I would probably support it.
Okay. With that in mind, and perhaps even contradicting myself, because I think maybe if I was in charge, I'd rest a few players against Brazil or rather hold them back for Ecuador. But I think could be a bit of fun to end in What do you think our best slash most realistic 11 is to take on these qualifiers? And I'll put my neck on the line and go first. I'm going to go with a 4-3-3, with the middle three being like a holding midfielder and two box-to-box rather than a 10. So I'll go Fariñas in goal, Roberto Rosales at right back, Oscar Gonzalez at left back. I think he was very impressive in the September triple date. Adrian Martinez and Nahuel Ferraresi at centre-back. Thomas Rincon, Brujo Martinez and Christian Cáceres as the midfield three. And then the front three, if you like, Soteldo on one side, Aristegueta in the middle and Darwin Machis on the other side. My caveat to that is obviously Machis and Soteldo are both more used to playing on the left and would putting them one on the right, you know, is it going to happen? But other than that, perhaps Cordova would get the nod on the right. But that's what I'm going to go for as my 11.
Okay. So good. I mean, I think I'm going to have at least a few similarities. Yeah, Fariñas in goal for me. No question. Oscar Gonzalez for sure. I agree with that. He just was too good last window to, you know, there isn't an obvious reason to take him out. So we'll keep him in. Center back pairing is a little awkward. It's a little, you know, I liked what your idea, which was Martinez and Ferraresi. I'm going to go with that, with the one asterisk that I feel bad for Chancellor, because arguably he's been our best performing center back. But it, you know, from a broader standpoint, it feels risky to start him. There's just the way he compares to our other defenders. There's not a lot of good pairings for him to have. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm gonna have to leave him on the bench. But again, I mean, yeah, the guy's been one of the few dangerous players we've really had in the attack. I'll do the three midfield as well. Cáceres and Brujo, and you know, I have a real debate in my head about Moreno or Rincon. I might do Moreno. I'm usually a staunch defender of Tomas Rincon. I still am, but you know, he gets a lot of unfair comments on Twitter. Of course, everyone does. But you know, the last break, there definitely were some. It was a little rougher than I was hoping. So Aldo Moreno in there. And then I think I'm going to have the same front three as you. It's boring. It's like the same, but I'm going to have the same front. Oh, I didn't say my right back. Hernandez. Aldo Hernandez, just because he's had some really good form with Atlanta, and just to keep it different from yours. I think it'd be interesting to keep him in there. He had some good moments in the Copa America and in the last break. So I'll throw some youthful energy in there. Then the front three, I think the Machis Soteldo thing has its issues because of their preferred sides, but having Machis back is just feels so useful, and obviously has just a lot more experience at a higher level than a lot of this roster. So if you got to kind of have to find a place for him somewhere in there, and I agree that Aristegueta just feels like the only especially reliable option at the moment for center forward or striker. I would love to say that was Ramirez, but with the lack of minutes and kind of the poor performances in the last break, it doesn't feel safe. It doesn't feel safe to start him right now. So yeah, more or less same as yours, a couple differences.
So was that our one difference in the end, just the right back? I went Rosales, you went Hernandez, or did you
think so?
Twist with Rincon?
I said Moreno in the end.
Okay, so in which case, an added decision for you to make, who gets the armband?
That's a good question. Well, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the goalkeeper or the striker having it, but the two names that first come to mind are Fariñas or Aristegueta. One for obviously the sort of veteran status, Yeah. And the other, of course, for you know, the goalkeeper is always going to be a bit of a leader. And especially that Brazil game is going to probably have to do a lot of leading. Yeah, it's probably one of them for me. Maybe Moreno. It's a little more experienced at a slightly higher level than the other two midfielders. Just been in MLS a little longer, a little older than the other two. Maybe him. He's got a little more experience with Livinto as well. Yeah.
And to unrelated, of course, but moving away from the national team performances ever so slightly. Considering you spoke to that the Ukrainian podcast at the beginning of the season about Eric Ramirez, and we've seen him left out of the Dynamo Kiev squad entirely the past couple of games. What could you tell us? What insight could you give us as to perhaps what's going on in Ukraine with Eric Ramirez? Because I think I remember either listening to the podcast and hearing, or maybe you feeding it back to us, that the Dynamo Kiev coach, you know, takes a while to embed his new players into the starting 11.
Yeah, that is what I had heard. That, you know, he has a history of just being a little different with the way he flows in new players. And I do think that's part of what's happened. Obviously, the COVID concerns, the positive test results that Ramirez got also played a part in that. I'll admit that, and you know, it's hard to know how much the COVID influenced and didn't influence some of that, because we don't know the inner timelines with all that. But I will say, I did not expect it to take this long for him to be regular on the roster or on the starting 11. It'll be interesting to see once this break is done and we have a couple months, or not a couple months, but you know, where he'll have more time, hopefully with no COVID. It'll be interesting to see if he can finally get more regular minutes. It's a little concerning. It's a little concerning. It's not quite what I interpreted from what I was told. I didn't necessarily expect this much absence, but I also don't know, again, how much the COVID interfered. I will say Hernandez had the same timeline of getting a positive test, and he's been back with Atlanta for a while on the bench, starting training. I think he started against Montreal just a couple of days ago, but he was in the bench for a couple of games. So that does make it look a little worse that a player in the same situation was back with his team a lot quicker. But it's also the US versus going all the way to Ukraine. So, you know, there might be issues that I am not accounting for, but yeah, it's going slower than I anticipated, even with the warnings I was given. I'll say that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm hoping he plays more, not only because you and I bigged him up a lot and, you know, both agree that he's, you know, got a big part to play in the next 10 years of the national team alongside Dani Perez, hopefully. But yeah, also, you know, he's gone to, you know, one of the two biggest clubs in Ukraine. I think, you know, those two teams between them I read earlier in the week, have won like every league title in Ukraine for the past 20 something years. So it was a really big move for him to have at this stage of his career. And you just, you know, you want it to be successful. You want him to hit the ground running. Just goals are so important for strikers. And especially when, you know, they paid not huge money in terms of global football, but, you know, it was big to come from the Slovakian league to one of the top teams in Ukraine. So hopefully he gets those opportunities. And, you know, it's not something we look back on at the end of the year and start trying to analyze what went wrong. But to end on back with the national team, how many points do you think we're going to get from this 9? My heart would love to say we can get 4 points, a loss against Brazil, and then a draw or win against Ecuador, and similarly a draw or win against Chile. Not too sure what way it would come, but my head is saying maybe we're only going to get the 1 point. Can you give us more optimism than I'm offering?
It's become my role on this team, but yeah, I know, but it is mostly genuine, but I, you know, I'll agree that probably like what everyone should be sort of thinking is 4, like that's probably what we should have the realistic hope should be, is like a win Ecuador, a draw Chile or something like that.
And we double our points.
Time. Yeah. You know, and it wouldn't be great. At the same time, again, like I said, I think at the beginning of the show, it kind of does what I was hoping the window to do, which is just kind of to keep some sort of hope alive, some sort of momentum alive that there's something to play for. Yeah. Obviously, the hope, the thing we should all really hope happens is like six. That would get us to 10 points. If the rest of the table continues to be as jumbled as it's been, that could lift us a couple places. So that'd be my hope, because I back it with just the sense that individually, I think the Ecuador and Chile games both seem like games that could be won, albeit so did a lot of the games in the last window, and that didn't work out. So, you know, four is the realistic hope, and the insane hope is six.
Yeah, to just sort of hammer home the point, if it's not been made explicitly yet, it really is in front of goal that Venezuela is struggling. If you look at goals against, tally conceded 15, but, you know, Colombia in fifth have conceded more. They've conceded 16. Peru in seventh have conceded 17. Bolivia in ninth, one position above Venezuela, have conceded 22. So, you know, there's three teams that have conceded more. The problem is nobody has scored as few as Venezuela. Venezuela have five. The next lowest is eight. That's Peru in seventh, and then ninth, Paraguay in sixth, and Chile in eighth. So it really is in front of goal. Five goals scored from nine World Cup qualifying games is and of course they've missed Salomon Rondon hugely, and he's to thank for the winning goal against Chile, the one win that Venezuela had to their name. So we need a new hero, basically. We need a talisman. We need someone to get the goals that Rondon would usually get.
If we score a couple of goals in the Chile and the Ecuador games, if that happens, just remove all the stats. If a couple of goals are scored by us in those two games, I would even just see us winning them. The problem is, because our defense hasn't been bad, and most of the goals we've conceded have been really silly goals.
Yeah, particularly in the last month.
Yeah. The issue is, I just, you know, again, there's just, it doesn't really seem like we're able to score, and then we concede like one or two goals, and because we didn't score, we lose. Yes. So if someone here, or a couple people here combined, so Tuttle's had a nice little form recently, if someone can get that momentum and just score a couple of goals in those games, we might get good results. It's just, it hasn't happened for so long though.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And I was just trying to look, because my memory has failed me, who the draw was against in
Uruguay.
Yes, I was wondering. And yeah, the 0-0 in June. So, you know, both home games, we've only got points at home so far. A win against Chile and a draw against Uruguay. So that, it's good opposition that the points have been picked up against. Now, that's the frustrating thing, because we then haven't picked up points in games we hope for us to.
Also, it would be really nice if we could play a game with 11 people.
Yes, that too.
That's my final note.
Yeah, no, we will end it there. And if anyone's listening to this before the game and fancies a flutter, it's probably not a bad idea. Some money on a Venezuela red card. Not that we are.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Okay. As always, Dominic, thank you very much. And hopefully you at home or on the car or on the bus or wherever you're listening have enjoyed it too. Until next time, goodbye.